She got a whole novel deleted and she never got it back. She hadn't submitted it for publication yet, but she was still working on it. But I heard that story and I went, oh my God. To lose a whole novel would be really devastating. It's like a house burning down or something.
Well, I've lost papers before many years ago now. I've lost but
things too.
Yeah.
Mysteriously.
Yeah. I was in a panic the other day because I had been working on a paper for a while and all of a sudden it wasn't where it should be. You know, so I thought, what the fuck? And looked around everywhere and panic. And finally I found it and I found a copy of it. And then I went back onto the regular place and it was back on there. Well, I don't know where it went for when it was off.
There's a trickster in your system, in my system too.
Yeah, it's funny because I was writing about the trickster, so maybe that's...
These little elves come out at night, you know.
Okay, Doug, you've got it up.
So everybody sees the red dot?
Yeah.
All right.
Good. So you're on, Doug, if you have something to say.
Well, now I've got all these windows open, so I'll have to close some things here. So this reading covered, I think, three of Bateson's essays and then three or four, two Nora Bateson poems and two essays of hers. All of them, I feel, need to be addressed. But I'm not going to do that. I think, for me personally, and based on what Bateson was saying, the one on Bateson's rule, perhaps we can tag in to the end of the call, depending on what you three feel like. Because he does make a note in the closing comments that that's kind of what the focus is on the fifth section of Ecologies of Mind, if I'm understanding that correctly. So when I read Bateson's rule, that was a little... In the Batesonian way, it made some sense now that I know the direction that he carries his writings. And we did have a bit on symmetry and the bilateral symmetry. There was one thing about that I'll note quickly that Nora mentioned in her poem or quick little ditty on reckless. So the ecology of recklessness is alive with the courage to shun a toxic normalcy. And here's where I thought it aligned with Bateson's rule, which is my maybe liminal understanding of what the Bateson's rule is. So she goes on to say, to recognize a misalignment as success and success as misalignment. What does it mean to be healthy in an unhealthy system? The sanity not require the madness to live otherwise. So I think that goes along with symmetry, asymmetry. But I won't go in that direction. I know Michael, if you're still present, you turned some of us on to John Durham Peters' The Marvelous Clouds.
Yes.
And there, that's, I think the subtitle is, he's pursuing an elemental, let's see.
Media.
Yeah, so he's into communications theory and sorry, I'm noticing that I had two of me. One. That's throwing me off now. I'm sure it's been throwing you guys off. Oh, jeez. There we go. But yeah, John Durham Peters is a stellar writer, but he packs in so much information. But in this book, he is taking earth, wind, fire, and tying it into kind of our core ontology and epistemology, and really tapping into what it means to live in the world, to be in the world. But in the second chapter, which he calls Of Cetaceans and Ships, or The Moorings of Our Being, I wanted to read a few quotes. So I'm not quoting Bateson here, so I'm kind of beating around the article we read, or the, so Bateson calls it the problems in cetacean and other mammalian communication. And he's essentially kind of working with applying the theory of logical types that we've discussed in the past, and applying that to now to the closest animal that at the time or current times can think of, which is this medium-sized dolphin, the bottlenose dolphin, I believe, or cetaceans in general. But I don't think I can do this chapter justice. So let me just go into the quotes here, and I want to, I know Johnny and Jeffrey have both at least read this once or twice. They might have a little bit more information or thoughts as to how Bateson ties this in. But
I don't understand this chapter. Bilateral symmetry totally stumps me. So good luck.
And I'm also reading John Lilly, The Mind of a Dolphin. So I've got all these voices trying to let me know what's going on in Bateson's head. So perhaps, as these quotes will show here, the world of the dolphin is its own complete separate world that we will never understand. And that's essentially what Bateson is getting at. And I would like to argue and perhaps write about that Bateson is his own ecology, and he's impossible to understand unless you just have the right people guiding you in the right direction as to what he's about. So here are a few quotes from that second chapter by John Durham Peters. So, if being in the world is a question of embodiment, then zoology, the study of the varieties of bodies, is its encyclopedia. These quotes are from John Lilly, Lilly's book, Mind of the Dolphin. But he's stating that we dominate the land, we dominate the surface world, and we've essentially killed off through competition all other species. So now it's just us humans here doing what we do, but we haven't had a chance to completely destroy the world of the cetaceans, the underwater world. So we're fascinated by them. We want to learn more about it. And another quote from Peter's chapter, which is actually a quote from Adrienne Rich, the poet. She says, "A book of myths in which our names do not appear." So our names do not appear in the book of sea myth. And this is back to Peter's. In one sense, then, the ocean is the primordial medium free zone, immune to all human attempts at fabrication. Now he goes on to describe cetaceans. which include whales, dolphins, and porpoises, descended from terrestrial animals that returned to sea and adapted by evolution. Cetaceans descend from hooved animals that returned to the sea somewhere around 50 million years ago. They are thus related to deer and cattle, though their closest land relative is the hippopotamus. Cetaceans are thus 10 times older than humans, who only started to emerge about 5 million years ago. Abandoning dry land, early cetaceans adapted to the sea habitat, developing some organs, especially their ears, nose, and throat, and reducing or losing other ones, such as hair, the sense of smell, and the hind limbs, which disappeared altogether. The bodies of cetaceans bear traces of the double history, aquatic, terrestrial, aquatic adaptation. Cetaceans are fully maritime animals, their bodies as radically dependent on the ocean habitat as ours are on the atmosphere and Earth. The water medium is their natural environment. Although they cannot directly drink salty seawater, they hydrate through the organisms they consume. The sea is taken for granted element, shaping all they do, like oxygen, gravity, ground, or fire, language, or celestial bodies for us. So I noted that Bateson's article is not necessarily about determining whether dolphins are at level zero, level one, level two. The way he's working at this, like it works well for human psychology or human communications. So I, at least in my mind, I perceive that Bateson is asking, does this need to be applied to animals or does it need to? Read a few more Peterson quotes, and then I'll just open it up and perhaps we can jump into some of Nora Bateson's work, talk a bit more about these essays. Peters goes on to say, measures of relative brain power are unreliable due to other factors such as neuronal packing density, but there is abundant evidence of social intelligence among cetaceans, and their complex social systems are often compared to those of primates. Sonar seems to be used for both environmental scanning and communication. There's evidence that individual voices can be identified among dolphins and that they have something like proper names for each other, distinctive whistle sounds unique to each individual. Dolphins can also recognize themselves in mirrors, a sign of intelligence found in only a few species. They form lifelong bonds. Whether they are capable of what some call metacognition, knowing about knowing, so as to infer the mental states of others and thus engage in such acts as politeness or deception, is disputed. Dolphins are talented vocal and motor mimics. The athletic claps and splashes their bodies make after diving into the air may also serve signaling purposes. Cetaceans also exhibit high-level altruism, including group hunting and mutual aid to injured conspecifics. I'll skip over that. I think I added in this quote, that this is 2 a.m. reading going on here, so pardon if this is a supreme tangent, but I'll finish with this quote here. Although their eyes operate independently, some dolphins may be the only cetaceans capable of binocular vision. In most whales, for instance, the eyes are mounted on the sides of the head, like those of fish. Melville speculates that experiencing a whale's visual field would be like looking sideways through our ears with blind spots directly in front of us and behind us. It would seem as if we had two backs and two fronts. Because of the bilateral placement of the eyes, he thought whales could entertain two visual fields at once and thus transcend the linear, one thing at a time mode of human consciousness. this was not the last time cetaceans were thought to live differently in time. Face-to-face communication would mean something very different among whales. Intimate concourse might mean swimming abreast. There would be no looking into one's eyes, just looking into one eye at a time. Cetaceans show the primacy of habitat and embodiment to communication. They reveal the existential, even at an anatomical force of habitat. So apologize for being a bit underprepared here. I'll open it up to whatever would like to carry this forth.
I'll just try to put my fishing line in, so to speak. I was drawn to the first part on 364, where the behavior of dolphins as communication seemed to be Bateson's kind of entry into somehow looking at behavior itself as communication and how that might work in terms of ecology and humans, and how behavior as communication has some roots in relationships and being relational. But he was very clear that because of the medium dolphins are in, water, and the fact of their own anatomy, then the way they process, I guess you would say, communication is distinct from humans. And he was not necessarily trying to learn to talk to them, but just to observe the patterns that they in their social environment. And that also led to an interesting thing later on of him, and Johnny's even, I think, referred to this, of comparing the digital and the analog and how that plays in to communication and observing behavior, I think. So that's one thing that was interesting to me is I just was intrigued of communication as behavior being a communication, because he talked a lot about the pre-verbal or, you know, the nonverbal, and trying to sort that out amongst the animal kingdom. But he was referring to there's a relationship to the way we ourselves work on that on that tool, on that level. But we have language that in our language, though, I think he referred, at one point he referred to the verbal as not quite totally digital because of the nonverbals.
Okay, maybe I'll jump in there and follow up on both those comments. I think to begin with, one should say that Bateson in this Cetacean text is very careful to say that he's not talking about intelligence. But in a way, I think he's also saying maybe intelligence isn't what we think it is to some extent. So it's kind of a strategy that he's taking to talk about intelligence by not talking about intelligence in a way. Because what he does is point out that the way humans communicate is this idea of, because we have hands, our language is all about manipulating things. And this comes up through Lakoff and Johnson's work on image schemata. So image schemata are these ideas I grasp an idea. So we use manipulation metaphors to talk about abstract ideas, because there's no other way to talk about them in our language than through these images that have to do with how we manipulate the world. And all of that is built into language. And so the way humans use language, we're essentially using a tool that was developed to talk about manipulable things. And we use it to talk about relations because, as he points out, relations is really what it's all about underneath, right? But dolphins, because they don't have manipulable appendages in the way, same way, they don't do that. They only they're limited in the terms and in the number of non-verbal, non-sound methods to communicate with each other. They can touch, but they can't do a lot of the things that they can move, but they can't do a lot of things that that humans do. That they organize their relationship discussions through a kind of sonorous communication that is not talking about things. But it's a very interesting understanding of the Cetacean world, I find, and very different from the John C. Lilly's or the other, not that their work isn't very interesting too, but they tend to anthropomorphize what's going on with the dolphins and the whales. And Bateson is very careful not to do that, maybe because he's an anthropologist and is trained to, you know, in a way to not do that. So I do find that the emphasis on the fact that all mammals, and maybe to a certain extent, perhaps all living beings, but certainly all mammals are essentially exchanging information about relations. I think, you know, as a first level, right? So I think that's, you know, so we talked about the other time about the idea that human beings are relational fields and that we need to recast our thinking in terms of relational fields. And of course, what stops us from doing that is because we use a language that is structured around things rather than relational fields. And that's why it's so difficult to hold in our minds this idea of relational fields. So that's for the Cetacean. And there's a lot there going on in terms of the way he describes what's going on. But I just think, because I do think people tend to assume that intelligence is something about the way we use language. And Bateson says, no. Intelligence can be something very different. And he's more focused on learning. Well, that's his ideas as well, anyway. Uh-huh. He's more interested in learning than he is in intelligence, in a way. So I think...
Does that tie into... Because he brings in the notion of motion, how much motion plays into communication, right?
Yeah, certainly for humans and the way we move our eyes and our, you know, and our heads in order to...
But is that a crossover with dolphins? Because you mentioned dolphins. Do they communicate by the way they move?
I think they do. Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Okay. The term was K-I-N-E-S-I-C.
Kinesis, yeah.
Yeah.
To jump in on the other question of the bilateral symmetry. So again, for this paper, although I do see the two papers as being related, the issue of bilateral symmetry is that the key point of this paper is that normally people think of symmetry as a kind of information. That is to say, people look at things like animals or humans or mammals who have the two sides of the body being a mirror reflection of each other and say, oh, well, that's a reflection of some sort of design. it's this idea that there's, you know, even the whole creation thing around religion is this idea of intelligent design, but it's this idea that symmetry is a result of somebody's effort. And Bateson says, no, that's not the way it works. Symmetry is a relaxation of effort. It's asymmetry that requires effort, that requires extra information in order to, because if you take out the extra information, things will naturally go to symmetrical forms. And so the natural root is symmetrical forms. And I think it's a very interesting argument. I think in a, just like with many other things that Bateson says, the world hasn't caught up with Bateson yet. Even 75 years after some of this work was done, the world still thinks the way he's sort of arguing against, that symmetry requires effort, or that relationship communication requires effort. So this is where the two things are linked, because in a way, the argument about the root process of human beings, of all mammals, is to use movement and gesture and posture and breath and these kinds of things to talk about relationships. And then the extra effort is to talk about things, the manipulable things in language, right? So there's a kind of a parallel between the paper on bilateral symmetry, which says certain things take extra effort and other things are automatic, and the paper on communication, which says that relationship communication takes no effort and talking about things takes extra effort. And so that's the way I link the two papers. And I do think the arguments are fascinating. I know when I read this thing about, he said, when somebody tells you, oh, I'm going to take a flight at 6:30,
yeah,
you're actually devoting questions about, why is this person telling me this thing? What does it say about their relationship with me that they are telling me this thing? And of course, we all do that. Yeah. And most of our discussions about our things underneath are about our relationships, right? So maybe I'll stop there, because I have a lot to say about the Nora Bateson stuff as well, but maybe that's a first. So I'm just trying to clarify some of what I think Bateson is talking about in these two articles.
That was very helpful for me, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, that was helpful for me too. He made a point, didn't he, Jeffrey, that humans are able to be very specific. You know?
Well, specific has to do with our manipulation.
Yeah, okay.
Because in order to manipulate things, we have to do things very precisely. It's one of the things about, like, the cognitive, the brain devotes something like 40% of its total volume to handling precise movement, because all of that takes a lot of neurons to do well. So right. There's good chunks, large chunks of the brain are devoted to letting us do that. Well, you know, if you don't have hands, and then your brain is organized differently, it doesn't do that, right? It does something else.
So that would lead to the verbal language being part of that, making specific graphic.
Yeah, so there's this argument that we developed a language, and I think maybe it's in that text, I can't remember. I'm reading so many texts right now, I don't know who wrote what, but there's this idea that when you say up, you raise your hand and your lower jaw goes up. To say the word up, your lower jaw goes up. To say down, your lower jaw goes down and you lower your hand. So there's a sense in which language at its roots is actually analogous. It's actually, what's the term? Digital and
analog.
Analog, yeah. So it's actually analog in its construction language underneath. Uh-huh. And so, the argument is we developed this verbal means of talking about things in order to keep our hands and our bodies and our gestures free to talk yeah. about the real things, which are relationships.
Right. Well, that kind of parallels, or it feels like it parallels, that I've always felt that language has a physicality. I don't know if that's a good word to use, but there's a physicality to it.
Yeah. I mean, and that certainly goes with the sort of embodied modern approach. I mean, yeah. I would almost say postmodern, although that tends to mean something else, but because the modern preoccupation in cognition is still with a disembodied approaches, but the more recent approach is to say things are actually embodied, and that's true about language as it is about many other things that are going on in the body. So.
Okay.
I'm sure Johnny has things to say. So
thank you.
Yeah.
This is very stimulating. Very difficult actually to get a handle on. I'm a very kinesthetic proprioceptive. My hands are very, the mind and the hand and the eye and the hand, I think are extremely important to us tool users. And I think Bateson was extremely sensitive to this. And when he makes this comment, I personally do not believe that the dolphins have anything that a human linguist would call a language. I do not think that any animal without hands would be stupid enough to arrive at so outlandish a mode of communication.
I love that line.
To use a syntax and category system appropriate for the discussion of things that can be handled, while really discussing the patterns and contingencies of relationship, is fantastic. But that, I submit, is what is happening in this room, the room I think where he's talking. He's having sounds like a lecture to me.
It's a lecture, I think, yeah.
He says, I stand here and talk while you listen and watch. I try to convince you, try to get you to see things my way, try to earn your respect, try to indicate my respect for you, challenge you, and so on. What is really taking place is a discussion of the patterns of our relationship, all according to the rules of a scientific conference about whales. So it is to be human. And I think that something else he says in the paragraph right above this, he says, he's talking about dolphins and whales and how they're underwater. So they don't have mobile faces that would communicate to another the way a cat or a dog or a bear communicate to us. We look at their nose, we look at their mouth, we look at their eyes, we look at the hair on their back, we look at what they're doing with their ears. All of these are signals, they're communiques from, but they're mammals, so we can pick up on this. Then I think there's special relationships. He goes on, he says, it is reasonable then to suppose that in these animals, vocalization, he's talking about the dolphins again, they're underwater, so they can't see underwater another dolphin's facial expression. So that they don't have a face the way we have a face, where we're signaling to each other all the time. You know what that means. and I can say, oh yeah, I'm really happy today. You know that's not true. You just hear the tone of my voice. You hear you hear two different messages. And this is what Bateson is really creating a whole science out of, is this the digital and the analogical. And by far the most important carrier of information to another is the analogical, not the digital. But the digital is extremely important. and has a very important function in our lives. It actually, I think, connects us to memory, very long-term memory. And that's why we have books. People who lived and died centuries ago, we can still be in communication with them. Because we have alphabets and we have sentences and we have paper and we have pens and we do this writing and we do this reading thing. And this is something I think does not happen with other species, because they don't have these hands and the opposable thumbs that can make sense out of reading and writing. But he says something interesting about the dolphins, and that is vocalization. So he says, it's reasonable then to suppose that in these animals, vocalization has taken over the communicative function that most animals perform by facial expression, wagging tails, clenched fists, supinated hands, flaring nostrils, and the like. We might say that the whale is the communicational opposite of the giraffe. It has no neck, but it has a voice. This speculation alone would make the communication of dolphins a subject of great theoretical interest. It would be fascinating, for example, to know whether or not in an evolutionary shift from kinesics to vocalization, the same general structure of categories is retained. And so he goes on and says, my own impression, and it is only an impression unsupported by testing, is that the hypothesis that dolphins have substituted paralinguistics for kinesics does not quite fit in with my experience when I listen to their sounds. So I think he's suggesting that they may not have a syntax or a grammar, but their sounds are communications much more like song than like speech to one another. So they're giving each other a tune. They're tossing back and forth a mood through the tonalities and the different registers, because they can get very high pitched. And whales, of course, have these huge basso voices, you know, which echo for many, many miles underwater. So I think these are fascinating to think about. And also, I want to tell you a story about something that the first time I realized I was a mammal. And I had taken, in you know, elementary school, I learned about, you know, the different animal kingdoms, you know, about mammals and amphibians and fish and reptiles, et cetera, et cetera. But I was about 16 years old. I was with a friend of mine, Dennis. We were in a coffee shop somewhere late at night. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know how in the hell I did that. my parents were freaked out when I would come home stoned and drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I knew I was going to get in trouble when I got home. So I stayed out as late as I could, since I'd already broken my curfew, right? So anyway, here in Dennis and I, and this old guy with a cowboy hat came in, and he had cowboy boots. He sort of reeked of marijuana. And he invited us over to his place for, you know, tequila and smoking a joint or whatever. And I didn't like the guy, but my friend wanted to do this. So we hopped into the car. We followed his truck, this guy's truck, out on a gravel road, way outside of the city limits. We got out. There was a little shack. And he got out of the truck. We got out of our car. And he said, he let us know that he collected snakes, poisonous snakes. And I went, oh, okay. And then he opened the door of this little shack, and he pulled a light, a switch, and the light came on. I smelled something really weird as soon as I walked in there. It smelled like something that I recalled from the zoo. And sure enough, in little glass cages in this shack, there were just hundreds of snakes. He said he had about 200 of them. And he had a bag of, you know, he had mice. He had to feed them live. But he wanted to show us his prized possession, which was a king cobra. And he pulled it up. He had a stick. He pulled it up. He threw it on the ground. And the cobra rose up, you know, with this, and it looked right at me. And I was in a corner of the room and couldn't escape. And I had no stick. my friend, fortunately, he grabbed a stick, and this guy had a stick, and the snake was looking at me, the cobra, the king cobra, and it was going, pff, pff, pff. And I said, what does that mean? He said, that means it's getting ready to strike. And I went, oh, shit. And then he said, but don't worry, we're close to hospital. You know, they have a what do you call it, an antidote. And he also told me it's a slow striker. It's not like a rattler. This is all very useful information when you're in the corner of the room and you keep spitting at it. But what I sensed was I wasn't frightened as much as I was just shocked to be in the presence of this very ancient intelligence that was, and I knew for the first time in my whole life that that was cold-blooded and I was warm-blooded. And that's about all that creature knew about me, is that I was warm and that it was frightened. It had been disturbed. But luckily, and it did whiz past me. I felt it whiz right past. Fortunately, I was wearing blue jeans, and it went right past my leg. And my friend, and then the guy grabbed it and put it back into the cage. And then at that point, I said to my friend, I want to go home. So got back into the car, and we were driving out, and the guy goes, yee-haw, you know, getting really drunk. But that was a very interesting, I thought, communication from a relational field. And I think the cobra was, when it would spit, it's doing a courtesy to the creature that is in its path. Because these are the king cobras are pretty fatal if you're bitten by one. So I think the guy was lying to me about an antidote. I don't think there is an antidote, but maybe there is. But at any rate, to feel that experience of being a warm-blooded creature in the presence of a cold-blooded creature. And we weren't at the zoo. There was no glass that separated us. We were in the same space together, trying to make sense. I was definitely trying to make sense of this very novel kind of situation. But I've been in other situations like that, with other species and with my own species, where the communications were so weird that I didn't have any past experience to give me any kind of guidance. So there were no best practices, especially if you're in an elevator with someone who has a knife and says, give me everything you've got. Those are the kind of situations where, what's the best practice here? I can't remember. So, and I've been held up like 3 or 4 times, and they were all different situations. And I never repeated myself in those situations. And I'm still here. But I'm just saying, just to change the subject a little bit, what I think he's talking about with the voice. I posted something earlier this week with the guy who studied songbirds. And I think that he's making, he's made a study of the voice of whales, dolphins, bats, seals and walruses, and humans and songbirds. We all have similarities in how we use the voice. And this is a very interesting study. And I'm not sure, I'd have to go into it much more depth than I have, but it does appear that there may be some rudimentary kind of syntax happening. And I know you've had some experience with songbirds, Doug, out in the wild, and how we can communicate through the voice different kinds of qualities, which may be analogical, mostly meant analogical, but there may be some syntax. For instance, they noticed deaf people, deaf mute persons, they are able to communicate to one another through gesture. And many, there were early speculations that they had no syntax, that this was not a language, these were just signals. We now know, of course, that's not true, that sign language is a language and there is a grammar, there is a syntax. So there's syntax, there's pragmatics, and there's semantics. And these have been divided up and studied separately. And I think there are many people who are coming forward and just saying, you can't study this stuff separately. And I think that's interesting. And there's pragmatics, how we actually use language and gesture and tone and physiology. And the voice is inside of us and outside of us at the same time. So I experience my own voice internally, and you experience it also externally and internally, because you register the affective spaces of another when you hear the tone of voice. You can tell where it's coming from. Is it a relaxed voice, a tense voice, a fast voice, a slow voice, a little of both, how it changes from high to low. These are all like song rather than like speech. So I think this is what's interesting, is these overlaps between song, speech, and what he's calling paralinguistics, paramessages, messages about the message, and the different levels. So it's quite interesting, I think, where he's going with all of this. And I think he's just putting certain things, some of this very complex, these very complex landscapes that each organism has created a niche for itself. And we have done that as well. And we have hands and we have feet. That's very different from being a bird or a fish or a whale. So it's just interesting how we bring forth all of these different worlds on this planet. And I think we're just getting started to figure any of this out. I think it's way, way premature. I don't think any of us have, even the people who are really cutting edge are somehow at a loss to figure this stuff out. But I think this is very promising what this guy is doing with the songbirds and the differences and the similarities between the songbird and the human. And it's interesting because chimpanzees and apes, who are more close to us genetically, we're very far away from, in terms of they could probably pick up a little bit of what humans are doing when we're speaking, but not much. They basically are grunting and groaning. But if they're domesticated and they get a lot of attention and rewards, they can start getting a glimmer of maybe what we do with symbols. But anyway, I'm just sharing all of my confusion with you and my fascination. These are great topics.
Wonderful ideas about the singing. It's interesting, in my science fiction saga, I have, I think, 5 alien races, alien species, and only four of them sing to communicate. And they have no hands, none of those four species. The one species, it doesn't have hands, it has the ability to form manipulators at will. They're the only ones who use language the way humans do. So I think instinctively, I tell you, I think I have Bateson I have a shadow Bateson inside myself that I acquired early on in my life Everything I do is somehow Beethovenian in its import, but so I'm anyway, I think it's kind of interesting. And I'm thinking too, in relation to Nora Bateson's the first long essay that she writes about. She's kind of telling us all to be careful about all the work that's going into Holochain and all the alternative economies that are under development around the world, that that they all look very sincere and intelligent, and you know, their efforts to deal with the current crisis in particular ways on the economic side, but that they are somehow missing the point. And she argues that instead of looking at alternative economies, we should be looking at money itself and the idea of money and what's going into the idea of money.
Especially ownership.
Yeah. And when I wrote I mentioned this a couple of times. I have a manuscript of a thing about the paradoxes of the 21st century that I wrote 15 years ago, and I didn't publish it. And the reason I didn't publish it was because I got stuck on the problem of economy inside the book. I'm not an economist. I've never felt I really understood economics. And I ventured to say some things in the book, and then I got very unsure of myself about the statements I was making about the economy. And so I ended up deciding that I would work out the economical issue first before I went forward with the publication of the book. And well, I'm also an active researcher, and the real world caught up with me, and I never got that work done. And so it's sitting there in the background and has been for a number of years. But I do think, I'm not sure that I understand economics anymore, but I do think that these different writers are asking these questions about economics in ways that I think parallel the questions that I was asking then. And so I'm now thinking that I should bring the book forward to get it publishing. But I think it's interesting, this, because I agree with Nora Bateson. I think that there's, although I find the work on Holochain and all the rest of it very interesting, I have my doubts whether or not it's really, you know, it's, and then I was thinking, well, maybe what, because she talks about this sort of I can't remember the term she uses, non-trivial and complex relationships. So a kind of an economy that carries the complexity of our relationships inside the economy. And I was listening to John talk about the songs. I was thinking, that's what we need. We need a song-based economy. Because songs have all that complexity built into them.
I love that idea, Jeffrey. We should think seriously about that. You'll be in a grand opera, that's for sure.
Yeah, and maybe there are some songs that do it better than others. I mean, I think opera is very complex. I think maybe Britney Spears is not so complex in the same way, but mind you, it's very relational what she does, you know, or these people, what they do as well. But
hypothesis is that these songbirds, what they're basically communicating is, I'm sexy. That's the message. And it's usually directed towards some sort of potential mating ritual with another member of the species. But it has other effects besides. It elevates the mood of us humans who are nearby. And when we hear the songs and spring of the birds around us, we start feeling sexy too. And also the plants start to flower and the leaves start to come out on the trees. And they did a study because they were moving these trees to another location in another part of the world. And they were adolescent trees. They were still young. And they were able to grow. They fed them and everything and gave them proper light and nutrition. But they weren't flowering. And someone had the brilliant idea of like bringing in birds from their tropical, the location where they were native. And they brought in the birds. And when the birds started singing, the trees started to flower. Now that's a very wonderful thing that these, that may not be the intention that the birds have, but if I think so many, it is orchestrated, our ecologies, that there are given and received many kinds of messages from many species, and it's timed so that the eggs hatch when there's a food supply. And unfortunately, through our pesticides and our agribusiness dominating everything, we have destroyed these niches, which are orchestrated around birth when there's plenty of food. So a lot of these species die because the eggs hatch, but their food supply has been postponed because of some fertilizer that has prevented the worms from coming out at that time when these little birds hatch. So the birds die, that species is gone, and that species won't come back. So I think that's the kind of trauma we're in. And I'm just reminded of this, something she says at the end of this discussion on forgiveness, the ecology of hurt and forgiveness. And what in the world could forgiveness mean when we're living in the Anthropocene, with these mass extinctions that are just starting and the oceans dying? And she says, we all live in the stories as they play out in decades to come, just as we are now living in the aftermath and with the consequences of decisions made in the early and mid 20th century. She says one approach, she sort of lists a recipe of responses. One, define a polarity. Two, add trauma and drama. Three, panic in search of a solution while the situation blooms into cascading and overlapping destruction. Four, define a solution within another polarity. Five, repeat steps 2 and 5 indefinitely. This is what I call a solution-based operation here, which I've always been sort of opposed to. I mean, if it's a simple problem and you can solve it through something that's already been solved that way before, great. But if it's a novel situation, seeking a solution is not going to help. It's usually going to make things worse. Then she goes on to say, when things get too painful and repetitive, we might try this approach. Number one, allow complexity. Two, pause the impulse to find a cause. Three, increase mutual learning within the situation. Four, previously unseeable possibilities appear. Five, repeat steps 1 through 5 indefinitely. So I think she's talking about the need to be creative, to be experimental, to take risks, to do things differently. I think when we're in complex and stable systems, we need to be able to press the pause button, because we've tried to do the thing we've done before, we're going to get worse results. And we have to, rather than get caught up in fantasy but of causes and effects, because complex and stable systems are too complex for that. And I believe that she's offering a different kind of formula. I would add to this something that I learned from the U.S. military. When you're in a complex, unstable situation, number one, capture the high ground. Number two, stay in touch. Number three, keep moving.
Um, one of the going back a little bit, I like this phrase that she gave in answer to what if we need to rethink what money is, and having a the currency that holds relationality. When you were describing the birds and that, there's a current, I think there's that current of relationality, and it's been severed. And the way I believe the way that she's trying to say, the way we think about money, it decontextualizes so that we're not in touch with the current of where it, how money is flowing. And and I personally, like, I've taken that money to me is, to me it's just energy. I pass it along. I'm very, very mindful of how I use it, where I use it, rather than thinking of money as something that defines who I am. It's something that comes through me, and I need to do my home economics. I need to know how to, you know, that on that very raw level, home economics, how I manage that resource, you know, that's part of many resources that I have to operate in. And I think that current to me is that eros that is about that raw energy of life that's manifesting many forms. And most of us think of it about in the lower ground, in the lower, you know, lower chakra of just, you know, capitulating, coitus. But to me, the erotic energy now, the way I use it is, it informs the way I touch with my mind things or people. And I had a conversation with a female friend yesterday, and I finally realized what throws me off about her. Because a lot of her talk is about, she seems to be around how men abuse sex. And I get that. I get that. But she's also cut off of not being in touch because she doesn't give out, gestures of gentle touching, you know, as far as communique. Or when I touch her, I feel like, oh boy, you know, there's a little tension there I try to be aware and sensitive of not being overbearing with my sense of gestures, but I can also feel when people have twisted that whole erotic energy of not allowing it come through with how we use our gestures of touching somebody on the shoulders, or, you know, the way we use our voice. Does this make any fucking sense?
Yeah, I think Bateson even says something to that effect, that I can't find the quote, but there's something about, if you say to a girl, I love you, she's likely to pay more attention to the accompanying kinesics and paralinguistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Themselves.
Yeah.
She's stupid if she's just listens to what you say.
Exactly.
He's picking up on how you say it.
Yeah. But this whole issue around the puritanism of sexuality has been, I think part of the issue is not knowing our sexuality is not just in the lower half of our body. It's in throughout our it's how our bodies want to express and share itself, whether it's in song or just like we're doing it across this medium. You know, but the sound of my voice, the tone, and everybody's, that's a form of touch. And in a sense, to me, I just feel it represents erotica in the sense life being alive.
Yep, exactly. That's the way I understand eroticism.
Thank you.
As our connection with the universe.
Yes, right.
As opposed to sexual desire or something. Not that that isn't there and part of it.
Oh, yeah, right. I don't want to do away with it, you know. I just don't want to get so entrapped, like, you know, either you want to shut it off or you're going out and being totally irresponsible with your own sexual energy.
To come back to your point about energy, I do agree with you. when I wrote this book about, the book is really about the way we're in a movement, a social movement toward away from the center. And it was a looking at what does that imply in terms of what changes are going on in our society, because we're moving away from the center. And the reason why it was focused on moving away from the center is because in a world where the population is increasing exponentially, which was the status before the 1960s, we were in a divergent world. But after the 1960s, when the population rate of increase was slowing and we were in an asymptotic relationship, we're in a convergent world. And in a convergent world, centers no longer have any sense. It's peripheries that matter, or it's networks that matter, if you like, or connectiveness that matter, and not centers. The centers only works in a divergent world. So it was an exploration of these issues. And what I thought, because I had been reading about the social economy at the time, and I thought, my sense was the social economy is the economy that's beginning to take hold to replace the profit economy. But the idea of, my idea was never monetizing the social economy. And people today, when they talk about the social economy, they tend to talk about monetizing it.
But
to me, the social economy is the complexity of relationships in the social sphere, and you don't want to monetize it. You monetize it only to convert stuff towards the monetary economy, but you essentially want to replace the existing monetary economy with a social economy with all its diversity and complexity, and reduce the impact and the importance of the monetarizing part of it, right?
Right.
So that's my understanding of it.
I like that, Jeffrey. That follows my intuition. You put words on my intuition.
So I feel I must speak to what's being said right now, and it's, I have an ecology of metaphors building right now. And it's going off of your energy work that you just, the currency and current, and Jeffrey's center and the periphery, and he corrected himself, said no, it's more of the networking. So if we go back to your problem, the erotic encounter, so that's a centered approach. She's taking the central approach, or we could say we develop from the sexual center, and we've been slowly branching away from that into different ecologies of mind. And so she's limiting herself and limiting your relationship with her. But if we take, some of us are experiencing spring right now, and some of the trees too. The trees are releasing an assault of pollination mechanisms. Seeds falling to the ground, birds spreading seeds, birds singing songs, which make us want to come outside, even though we might have bad allergies. And we carry on this seed spreading. But I don't think any tree is thinking it's going to sexually abuse us or try to produce any hurt. There's none of that going on. There's some sort of core existence of the tree, of the flowers, of everything else going on that doesn't need to change and is how it is, and it's just the right amount of right. But there's all sorts of messiness that's involved in it. And I see that the same with the economy. There's a lot of, I don't want to go the wrong way with UBI, Universal Basic Income, but I know Johnny and the generations conversation that's been happening Tuesday nights, or Eastern Tuesday nights, they've been discussing that seems like the most logical step to take, and But then I listened to other voices, Douglas Rushkoff. I tune into every now and then. He has a lot of good ideas. Is saying that UBI is actually, he's not saying it's a handout and that it's the easy way out, but he's saying it's more of a lack of ownership. It's a lack of, it's going to suppress the individual, not even more than already. It will allow, of course, so many people that don't have access to the most basic needs to simply have access to that and not have to go through the trouble. But he's saying that it's giving even more less power to the people, and it's promoting consumerism. So it's going to insert that. But he suggests a step further, which is more of the visionary, even more visionary than something like universal basic income, is universal basic assets, which would give some sort of ownership back to the people. So it's taking money out of the question. So to give people money is great. Of course, that might be the only political way out of our mess right now. But ideally, there would be this distribution, the ownership back to the people, but not necessarily for their own power gain. But it's this networking effect. Those are my thoughts for now.
So I have a question, and I'm not, and maybe Jeffrey or Johnny can answer. It feels like there's this binary between digital and analog, and there's this work trying to go on how to transcend, include, or not stay frozen or pluralized in that polarity or that binary. And so that's the gist of it, but this is the physical representation of the dilemma I have with this from my own physical trauma that I suffered, is that, just to give you an analogy, is I suffered a tractor accident where I had the bucket up so high trying to reach out and put and dump rock that I tumbled over. And that's what happened. So I was reaching too far. So ever since then, there's been this me working with how to not overextend and still maintain a center, or this maybe a better, how do we come to a place where we intermingle, interplay between working with a sender and extending? And I'll just leave it to that, because I don't know where else to go. I think I painted the dilemma that I've been working with for a long time, that right now it's not so much a dilemma because I've been working with it so long that I have a comfortable uncomfortableness working with it, if that makes sense.
Again, I need a little bit more.
Go ahead.
What exactly you're asking us. So,
well, you mentioned that we've lost center and periphery. Okay. And it seems like we have. And because of that, there's no grounding, is just the way I'm feeling into it, Jeffrey.
Yeah, it's not center in the same way. It's center in the way of social center, you know. So in our social organizations, everything, you know, we create institutions, we create organisms, everything is designed. You know, what is an institution essentially? It's a way of putting a group of people together so that they resist the influences that try to pull them apart.
Okay.
And in a world that's divergent, institutions have their place. Mm-hmm. But in a world that is convergent, mm-hmm. it's not, we're no longer getting pulled by things trying to putting us apart. We're getting pushed by things that are trying to put us together, because we're in a very different world. And so institutions can't play the same role in that context that they do. So it's more this kind of argument. The issue, I think the issue that you're talking about is very interesting, though. It's this idea of, so it's again, it's embodied idea about needing to be, you know, as human beings, we need to be on our base, right? So our feet have to be apart in order for us to sit, stand in such a way that we're on our pace, right? So that,
and we're, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems like we're learning to have our base be dynamic and move, not just rooted.
Well, I was going to say, you know, what is walking? Walking is a process wherein which we throw our bodies off our center.
Yes,
yeah. And that forces us to move forward and take another step. Okay. And so walking is an example of a disequilibrium, re-equilibrium process.
Well, that's why I love to walk. I love to walk. Yeah. So that makes sense. It seems to be of center, recenter, or, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Just to come back to Doug's point, I'm slightly uneasy with the idea of ownership to begin with, because I think if you look at what ownership is, it's, first of all, it's grounded in the mind-body separation. As soon as you separate mind from body, and it's grounded also in the control method, the control situation. So the idea even of ownership. So if you start to change what you mean by ownership for moving it into different contexts, you are still grounded on the idea of ownership, which is rooted in, because the control situation is a result of the mind-body separation. If you have a mind and your body separation, then you think that your mind has to control your body. That's the, and therefore you organize the world into a controlled situation, which is what we've done. And ownership is the incarnation of that, in a sense. It's the way that all of this gets nailed into our structures. But if you start to question that kind of way of looking at things, I think you have to question ownership as well.
I haven't read too much on UBA or the Universal Basic Assets, but it's more of speaking directly of the commons. So I'll have to do more research, but yeah. Obviously tying that in with the economy, how does...
You and your wife would each get $10,000 a year. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say no to that. I think I'm a senior, so I may be disqualified because I'm getting Social Security. But there are many people in the Middle West, in the Midwest, the manufacturing jobs are over and there are no jobs that they can be trained in that are coming around. So it isn't like there's another way out besides giving people money. It's the only way out for a lot of people. And,
right. And
it's in our interest, and it's in everyone's interest that these people have some sort of, the safety net has been dismantled in the United States in the 80s and the 90s. There's a long history of how it was dismantled, which I don't want to go into. It's too complex, mm-hmm. But basically Reagan and Thatcher, it was happening internationally. And we're seeing the backlash now is in Brexit and the presidency of Donald Trump, because the people who were ignored and the safety net was taken away and entrepreneurs got away with everything. They winners take all. We're seeing the effects of that at the community level. The communities are destroyed. And just as when that bird is hatched and there's no food supply, what happens next? That's happening to a lot of people all over the planet right now. So this is, I think, where I think Rushkoff, I've read his book, Future Shock, and I think we're in a phase space. I think we've never quite been where we are now before. with 20% of the, what is it, 5%, 20% of the ocean, the coral reef, has died in the last 3 years. There have been other, you know, disasters in evolutionary time, but I think this is the first experience that we've had on this kind of scale. So I think we're going to have to really start thinking very differently about money and about commodification, about relationships, about communities, about birth rates. Birth rates are going down in some areas, and about immigration. As populations start to age, you're going to need new people coming in. And there's big debates about that in China and the United States and in Europe, and immigration policy, and traditionally what immigration has been for is basically to prop up sometimes these vast inequities, rather than to distribute the potentials in an equitable fashion among the population, so that poor people are forced to compete with other poor people for increasingly lower wages. Now I think the conversations that I'm having with Davor and with TJ and De Barrett, hopefully others will join us. We're trying to use our imaginations to move towards a post-money world. And what in the world could that look like? And how can we, who have to pay mortgages and pay our rent and have to drive a car to get to a workplace so that we can do the things we're having need to do, you know, dealing with plastic bags and stuff like that at the grocery store, that has been outlawed in New York State, I'm glad to say, last week. They have been outlawing plastics in the supermarkets. So I think that's a very small, teeny tiny step, maybe totally inadequate. I think Hawaii has done it. There's one other state that's outlawed plastics. I think it's California. But I think we're gonna, and I think the EU has done something similar. But I think these are small baby steps, maybe too little too late, but just that we're making this effort and we're seeing some signs of life. Okay, we have to take responsibility, people. You know, because we're running out of gas. We all know that. We're all addicted to fossil fuels. We all know the gross national product is the mantra. Bigger, bigger, bigger is better, better, better. And we're getting some reports from the field just saying it ain't necessarily so. And I think we're in this phase space, and it's going to take a lot of imagination to start moving forward towards something that we know will benefit a lot more of us, maybe even better than ever before. We're at this bifurcation point. But the ruling elites, of course, are terrified, the 1%, that they're going to lose their status. They already got utopia. But I'm a utopian in my bones. I am a concrete utopian. And I would not have survived the harsh realities that I have survived if I had tried to make a deal with the way things were. Of course, I had to pass. I had to make a deal to survive in these inequitable, a playing field which was not equal. But I also was doing something else, something behind the scenes, and a lot of us were. And I call it triangulating from the margins. And there's many different kinds of margins. So in the spiel I've just given you, I want to look at convergent and divergent and wondering if that might not be just another frozen binary. Because I suspect that we're all diverging and converging. And I may not understand exactly the way you're using it, Jeffrey, but I think we're the institutions that we are working in sometimes do not support us at the level of our identity, but they may pay us money to do things that we do not like. But we're also seeing how devastating that is on people's immune systems and on their sense of sanity. That they're spending most of their time doing things they do not like with people they don't care about, while their families they're more and more alienated from. And I think we're having to look at the trade-offs, you know, for this commodifying tendency, which is hardwired in most of us. How can I turn this into a buck? It's really hardwired in us. And I think it's very hard for us to unlearn this. But I do think, I think I mentioned the great dancers who go from ballet to modern to hip hop. They can learn something new, but and they also have to unlearn something that they've already mastered in order to learn something new. And then they can do something like something hybrid. They can put together ballet and hip hop and modern because they've gone through that transition from learning to unlearning to learning again. So that's what keeps me motivated in these conversations that we're having here is, can we create safe enough spaces so that we can explore these sometimes what feels like really weird ideas, really odd experiences, you know, our gut feelings, our hunches, and with some sort of theory, multiple theories, many models we're working with, and can we come up with something that's actionable? And I think that we don't know yet. But I welcome any feedback from, if you have a chance to look at Davor's work. He's, I think, a brilliant scholar. He's a sociologist working in Berlin, but I think he has some brilliant ideas about how we could move towards